Last week's episode, we covered the case of young George Weyerhaeuser's kidnapping and the events that followed in 1935. However, in our 35-minute episode, we only skim the surface of a story with twists and turns that will keep you at the edge of your seat. The main source of our research was Brian Johnston's book, Deep in the Woods, which was released earlier this year. We're fortunate enough to have Brian on the line, all the way from Seattle, to discuss this fascinating true crime case. Brian, firstly, congratulations on a great book.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, it is truly a page-turner in every sense of the term. You must have felt like you've won the lottery when you discovered the story and found that no one has written a book about it. Yeah. For those of you unfamiliar with the Weyerhaeuser kidnapping, could you perhaps give us a brief overview of the case?
Brief? Oh, boy. I'll see if I'll do my best. All right. So this was 1935, in the middle of the Depression. And the Weyerhaeuser family, for people outside of the Northwest, they may not be familiar with the Weyerhaeuser family, but they're a very well-to-do family. They own timber, lots and lots of timber. As a matter of fact, they own approximately 4% of the entire state of Washington. At one time, and this still may be true, this is a really goofy statistic, but they owned 1/640th percent of all of America. So wow. George's great-grandfather, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, to this day is still considered the 12th richest man in American history, Bill Gates being number 11, just to give you some context.
Sure.
So Weyerhaeuser's well-to-do family. George Weyerhaeuser, 9-year-old son, walking home from school, snatched off the street 3 blocks from his house. Kidnappers hide him, chained in a hole in the ground in the forest, and have a ransom demands. And the first demand was $200,000 in small unmarked bills. Yes. One of the other ransom demands was, don't alert the media.
So at that time, that was something easier, yeah?
Right. So the newspaper promptly posted the ransom note on the front page of the newspaper. That's called irony. They wanted $200,000 in small unmarked bills. They had 5 days to get the money or else. Another demand was that the Weyerhaeuser family was supposed to communicate with the kidnappers using personal ads in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper. And so every day the kidnappers would flip through the personal ads until they would see a personal ad with the code name Percy Mini. And they would go, aha, the Weyerhaeusers are trying to talk to us. And so that's how they would communicate. And so when the Weyerhaeusers were ready to make the money drop, they would say, you know, we're ready to make the money drop. We're ready to make the drop, signed Percy Mini. And then the kidnappers would reach out to him and set up the arrangement for the money drop, which was an elaborate system straight out of a Humphrey Bogart movie. Honestly, I couldn't make the stuff up. And then they made the money drop. Kidnappers then returned George. And how they returned him is, again, it depends on how much detail you want me to go into, because the whole returning of him is an amazing story in and of itself. But I'll just say he was returned and then became what the New York Times called the greatest manhunt in Northwest history. FBI goes whole hog chasing after him. You got to remember, this is only 2 years after the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and murder. So, they were in all in. They eventually captured the kidnappers because the kidnappers were stupid, as most of them are. And they got sent off to prison. And then something even more amazing happens at the very end, which will completely restore your faith in humanity.
I just wanted to touch on the fact that you brought up the Lindbergh case. It seems like that was sort of almost a template. Like after that happened, it seemed like that was just the easy way to make money was let's just snatch a rich kid. Yeah.
Yeah. That was at this time. So, in the early 30s, the late 20s, early 30s, the criminals were like celebrities. Okay. They were like Robin Hood and everybody knew their names. You know, they knew Bonnie and Clyde and Babyface Nelson and John Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly, Pretty Boy Floyd. And then the FBI finally got fed up and said, nope, we're done with this. And so in 1934, Bonnie and Clyde were gunned down. And John Dillinger was gunned down and Babyface Nelson was gunned down. And so a lot of these criminals started going, you know, it might be a better way to make a buck by simply snatching rich people and having them pay up instead of getting into gunfights and things like that. And so, yeah, the Weyerhaeusers simply fell prey to that.
And I know we'll touch on this later, but in the kidnapping of George, it did seem like they just got, you know, a saint and a boy. Like, it's so interesting to me that I'm like, man, people like that did exist. It's something that personally I never really equate with somebody of money. Somebody, especially that young too, to have the wherewithal that he seemed to.
Yeah. You know, everybody had nothing but wonderful things to say about George. He was just a likable kid. And he was resilient. You know, one of the great coup when I was writing this book was that I got to interview George. I got to talk with George 85 years after the fact. And I asked him, I said, George, did you have any residual effects from this? Did you have nightmares or PTSD or anything like that? And he was like, nope, not at all, which I find absolutely remarkable.
No, and I mean, obviously hindsight's 2020. So it just seemed like it is one of those, it is what it is situations. And I mean, I don't think a lot of us, especially in this day and age, would have seen it that way, you know. But one thing that I want to bring up is that one role player that's very interesting to me is Harmon Whaley's 19-year-old wife, Margaret.
Yeah.
And how she became an unwitting co-conspirator. I mean, if I could say, like, just the way they painted her character in court as well is interesting. But would you mind sharing your impressions of her?
Yeah, absolutely. Poor Margaret. What a sap. I mean, I tell people there was 2.5 kidnappers. There was Bill Mahan, who was the mastermind. And then there was Harmon Whaley, who was kind of the sidekick. And Harmon's 19-year-old Mormon wife, who'd never been in trouble in her life, but went along and did everything her husband told her to do because that is how she was raised in the Mormon faith. Do whatever your husband tells you to do. Margaret was an idiot. Okay, so she didn't really participate in the kidnapping. She wasn't even aware of the kidnapping while it was going on for the first couple of days. Like I said, she wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. But she found out after George had been stashed in a hole in the ground, chained up for a couple of nights. Then they put him, they lugged him, and they were gonna stick him in the trunk of the car. But here's the deal. So Margaret is in the passenger seat of the car with Bill Mahan, and he drives her out into the forest. And she's like, Why are we out here in the forest? And he's like, Dad. Just sit here and shut up, and we'll be back in a few minutes. And then a few minutes later, Harmon walks out of the forest with a flashlight, and he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get on your hands and knees on the front seat, put your head down. I'm going to fold the seat over your head, and you're going to stay like that until I tell you otherwise. And she was like, what the? Okay, whatever. Okay. 2 seconds later, slam. She hears the trunk slamming, and she has no idea what's going on. Okay, now fast forward a few hours. They're driving across the state of Washington. They stop in the middle of the state to get some gas, maybe get some food. And suddenly, here's this voice that came out of nowhere saying, hey, mister, are you going to let me out of the trunk? So at this point, Margaret, all the puzzle pieces fall into place, and she's like, oh, my gosh. We've got George Weyerhaeuser, the kid who's been on the front page of every newspaper in America, in the trunk of this car. And at that point, Bill Mahan pulls out the gun and says, you will shut up or I will shoot you. I will kill your husband and I will kill the kid. And so she went along with things because she was scared. But she never once saw George in the entire time. She only heard him a couple of times, but she never saw him, which was actually a small mercy, because it gave her plausible deniability in the end.
It was a span of 8 days, but she just never laid eyes on the kid.
Nope, because they made it a point to make sure she didn't lay eyes on him.
Sounds like it was easy.
yeah. Well, again, when things went to trial with Margaret and again, you'll probably ask more questions about that later on, which was a humongous trial. It was like the biggest trial in Northwest history. But her lawyer, was the former mayor of Seattle, and he realized the best way to defend her was to position her as a complete and total moron, an absolute idiot. And he said so. I was reading the court transcripts, and he's saying, this woman is a complete idiot. She's the stupidest person on the planet. I've met a lot of dumb people in my life, and she takes the cake. If her husband told her to jump off a building, she would do it. I mean, this is how he was defending her. He's on her side, and he's making her look like just a moron. Didn't work. Didn't work.
No, it's unfortunate for her, especially to get, it's almost, I don't want to call it character slander, but I guess you got to do what you got to do from a lawyer standpoint. But when you put it into a contemporary context, that couldn't happen in this day and age.
No. The whole trial was so weird. I'm reading it going, in the newspaper, they post the names of all the jurists and who they are and what they do for a living and where they live. And even described him as better than average looking jury. Oh, it was just a weird, weird time back in 1935.
Well, you know, I mean, we're coming out of we're still in the Depression, I guess, at that point. And it's just, you got to do what you got to do. But that's the thing, like with what you're bringing up is that the events in the courtroom, and the way you write it, it's portrayed very beautifully. I mean, it feels like you're right there in the courthouse in Pierce County. Would you mind reading an excerpt so that our listeners can enjoy your visual portrayal of the events?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. As a matter of fact, since I actually had a chance to read the transcripts, every piece of dialogue in the book that takes place in the courtroom is verbatim. This is exactly what they said at that time. So her lawyer, a gentleman by the name of Dorr, he said, he's talking to the jury, says, I've met a lot of stupid people, maybe dumb ones, said Dorr. You could almost see her shoulders slumping in despair for his pathetic client, or so he would hope the jury to believe. But never have I met anyone whose stupidity is as great as this girl's. He slowly backed away from her and took a long, slow breath, like he was at a loss for words. He briefly then shook his head like he'd been lost in thought for a moment, and now it had regained his wherewithal. His demeanor changed to more resigned, what are you going to do kind of attitude. She was just a dupe for these two crooks. If her husband had sent her a telegram ordering her to jump off the building, she'd do it. And he paced away like he couldn't stand to even be around her. If they presented Academy Awards for courtroom stagecraft, he would have been a shoo-in.
If I can just take an aside too, just the way you delivered the reading of that, I'm a fan. it even makes you feel just like the weight of the scenario, like the weight of the stupidity that he's trying to paint her as. But no, thank you for that. And we do have to ask, like, why has there not been a movie about it?
Well, take my word for it. If you know somebody in the Hollywood industry, boy, send them my way. We're working on it. We are trying our best to try to get somebody interested because and this is no hyperbole on my part, none whatsoever. This is the most fascinating story that I've ever stumbled across myself. There are so many layers to this. On a nightly basis, I would run upstairs to my wife saying, you cannot believe what I just learned. I mean, it was all the time, every day, something remarkable. And it would be these little tiny just pieces of gold that I would uncover that just give it such richness. It's just an amazing, amazing story. I got so excited about it. And the fact that nobody had written a book about it, it still blows my mind.
It might be just something in our life and times too, right? That's what's beautiful about it is you're bringing it back to the forefront of consciousness. Because something that's like in print, obviously, if it's not online anymore, like it just sort of gets forgotten about in the zeitgeist. But with the book, I mean, I think you did that beautifully. And you've touched on this before. I just to touch back on it one more time, within your research, because the most intriguing person in the whole saga, and there are, you know, some characters here, but it's George again. It's George. Yeah. And we were saying just how he seems like, he just seems a lot more mature than you would expect somebody that age, especially in kidnapping. Like when I was a kid, before I've seen any horror movies or anything like that, my biggest fear was getting kidnapped. It literally was, and I'm being completely honest. So I just can't imagine somebody's like, okay, I'm just going to go with it. Like the fact that he understood what he was worth, that his parents had all that money, and the fact that he could stay calm in such the conditions that they kept him, And you met him. So you had touched on the things that he was saying, but would you be able to share any more impressions that you have of him? Like, because obviously, again, hindsight is 2020. He's at the more towards the end of his life than he was when he obviously kidnapped. Just what was his energy like, you know?
First of all, tracking him down was hard. It was really hard. And anytime I had seen any articles about the kidnapping, it would almost always say, George doesn't like to talk about the kidnapping. Okay. And when it was usually family members that were saying this. So when I called George, finally found a phone number that reached him, and it was free. It went to a voicemail that they would check once a week. And I just left a voicemail saying, George, Brian Johnston, local author, love to talk with you about your kidnapping, unless it's a really sensitive subject, not a problem. And imagine my surprise when he calls me back 3 days later and said, Brian, this is George. Happy to talk with you. Not a sensitive subject. Happened a long time ago. So I'm like, wow, holy crap. Yeah, that's awesome. So I go to his house and he's sitting outside on the back patio and he's just sitting there in the sun. And he gets up to greet me. And I go, George, how old are you? And he says, Brian, I'll be 94 next week.
94.
94. God, I should look so good when I'm 94. And we sat down in his sunroom with his daughter and we chatted and I asked questions. And, you know, he's 94, so some of his memories aren't as sharp, but he still remembered an awful lot. He got a big kick out of me showing him pictures of him in the newspapers from when he was 9 years old. He was laughing at that. And he was really engaging. He was funny. I asked him at one point, you know, after the kidnappers got caught and some of the money was returned, not all of it, because some of it got burned up in a stove.
Sure.
And
sure.
I asked him, you know, would the government, you know, make your family whole? Would they give the money back to you guys if it wasn't all there? He said, Brian, when have you ever heard the government give you money for free? And I was like, that's pretty sharp for a 94-year-old guy. And after we finished talking, he said, Brian, how long is it going to take you to write this book? And I said, oh, man, start to finish, 2 years. And he said, Brian, I'm 94. Write fast.
Was this 2 years ago?
2 years ago when I talked with him, yeah.
You know what I love about that? I just got to say is the fact that it's like he obviously having lived his life, he doesn't let that define it, but he also embraces it. And that's a really nice, you know, a nice thing to have about your aura.
I asked him, I said, George, I mean, come on, this is like an amazing story. Did you ever use it as a pickup line in college to meet girls? Or come on, it's the greatest pickup line on the planet. And he said, nope, never did. And I asked his daughter, and I said, did George just not talk with you guys much about this growing up? And they said, nope, never did.
It's news to me.
And here's a funny little story too on the side. A couple of days after I talked with George, I get this phone call from this guy, and he's not exactly a lawyer, but it had kind of lawyer overtones to him. You know, he's like a representative of somebody with the Weyerhaeuser Corporation.
Sure.
Mr. Johnston, I understand you've talked with George Weyerhaeuser a couple of days ago. I said, yeah. And he said, well, some of his family members have contacted me and they're very concerned about this. And why is that? Because George doesn't like to talk about the kidnapping. And I went, well, he was more than happy to talk to me about the kidnapping. And he's like, but he doesn't talk about the kidnapping. And I'm like, well, he talked to me. And he's like, so this is an article? No, it's a book. So it's a book of fiction? No, it's a book about the kidnapping. And he's silent and he's silent. And he finally goes, huh, weird. Well, you got lucky, Brian. Good luck with the book. And hung up. That's part of the Weyerhaeuser family. You know, when I was doing the research, it was really clear to see that back in 1935, the Weyerhaeusers, they didn't draw attention to themselves. Okay. They kept to themselves. They were very quiet, despite the fact that they were very wealthy. And to this day, you know, I asked George, I said, George, I mean, you're a rich guy. He said, Brian, I have no idea how much I'm worth. No clue.
It's not even important at that point, I guess.
Oh, I guess not. But that's just the way they are. They just like to lay low, be quiet, and go about their lives.
Well, in your personal opinion, do you think sort of his just his understanding of things as a more younger boy when he was kidnapped. Do you think the way he just soldiered on from that was that opinion? Was that what you did at the time? You soldiered on, or do you just think he was an exceptional kid?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One of the factors. One was at one point when the kidnappers were taking him off into the forest, they had him blindfolded and everything, and they were taking him across the stream. And George heard the water, and that's the one time he says that he got scared, because he thought maybe the kidnappers are done with me and they're going to throw me in the river and drown me. And he asked the kidnappers that, "Hey, mister, are you going to throw me in the river and drown me?" And the kidnapper said, "Kid, you're worth way too much to kill." And that's when George kind of went, okay. So I think at that point he realized, I just keep my mouth shut, then it's going to end up okay. Plus, I think, like kids will do, they will believe what they're told by an adult, by and large. And then on top of it, Harmon Whaley, who kind of watched over him for the 5 days when he was kept locked in a closet in Spokane, he said that Harmon Whaley was a very reasonable man. And so I think those three things combined made him realize, okay, I think I'm going to come out of this all right.
He's the one who kept him company, was the nice guy in the whole
yes,
life.
Yes, right? Exactly. Good cop, bad cop. He was the good cop.
Man, yeah, it's so interesting, especially because, you know, and it was spanning just past the Pacific Northwest, I mean, into Idaho and things like that. So just crossing state lines, it's definitely something that really paints a picture of the time. And I think, you know, and I think people would agree that you do it very well within the way you paint the story, because I think you got your tagline. You just said it. Like, the tagline for the film is, "Kid, you're worth too much to kill." There's your tagline.
That's the log line.
But just to close up, Brian, just want to say that there is so much to the case and the many things that's explored in the book, which give it a comprehensive context, from Hoover's FBI and the G-Men to the ambitious journalists looking for the scoop of the decade. Deep in the Woods provides a great breakdown on the case with easy to navigate information. But if you can tell our listeners where they can get their hands on a copy of it, where would be the best place to buy it?
You can get it at any bookstore. Honestly, you go to a bookstore and just say, if they don't have it on the shelf, then you can simply order it through them. You can get it ordered, obviously, through Amazon. You can get it through Barnes & Noble. If you're really desperate, you can go to my website, brianrjohnston.com. And they've got, you can click on something there to order the book also. But honestly, go to your bookstore, especially if it's a small bookstore. I encourage you, go to your mom and pop bookstore and say, "I'd like to order this book." And they would be very, very happy to take care of that for you.
Well, you know, as a mom and pop podcast, it definitely gets our stamp of approval, and we'll definitely put a link to your website.
Though, yay!
But thank you for the time, Brian. I mean, really, thank you for just writing a great book and taking the time out to speak to us.
It's my pleasure. I hope you guys all enjoy it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Oh, it's going to be 100%. And we can guarantee our listeners, if you pick it up, you probably won't be able to put it down. So do yourself that favor, especially with the holidays coming up.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you again.